Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stuart Thompson. Welcome to Personal Transformation. I'm broadcasting live from Gatehouse at 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard West in Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And, well, if you're not familiar with what the Gatehouse is, the Gatehouse is a place for survivors of childhood sexual abuse to come, both men and women. And it's also an investigation center, but it's a place to come and heal. And I'm broadcasting live from here tonight. Welcome to fall. Sure, coming in. Actually, winter's coming in our way now. A couple of things I should mention before I go any further. If you're at all triggered in any way, please turn it off or come back later on. Another thing I need to point out as well is that I'm not a therapist. I'm only here on a peer level only. I'm not going to tell you what you should or shouldn't do or anything of the sort. I'm only offering you my own experiences and my experiences at the Gatehouse through my healing. And what has worked for me may not work for you. So whatever I say, I'm making reference to myself. So please, folks, keep in mind, like I say, I'm not a therapist. If you're triggered, as I pointed out just a moment ago, if you're in the Toronto area, you can call the Gerstein Center, which is downtown Toronto, at 416-929-5200. Or you just go onto the website at gerstein.org, and I believe they have a chat there as well. The Toronto Distress Center, 416-408-4357, or 408-HELP. If you are west of the city, Peel Region Mobile Crisis Center Intervention, 905-278-9036. And their website is CN, I can't even see it, CN, Peel, Dufferin.ca. And last but not least, we have out in the, rather I had the wrong last time, actually. I'm talking about Peel, that's actually west. Now I'm going to talk about east, which is York Region. And surrounding area going down the Western Corridor, heading towards Ottawa, Kingston, Trenton, Belleville, places like that. We have an 800 number, either 1-855-310-2673 or 1-855-310-COPE. And locally at 905-898-6455. And you can reach them on the web at www.ysn.ca/310COPE. And if you are in the U.S., you also have RAIN as well. And they can be located at, you can go on to RAIN.org. There's a chat line there. It's called safehelpline.org. You can go on there and chat to somebody. And then just go on the website and you get the phone number. Or you can call at 1-800-656-HOPE. And I'm sure somebody will help you. Folks, thank you for tuning in. Tonight I'm going to be talking about grief. A lot of us survivors, well, pretty much everyone I've ever met has had some sort of grief or another in regards to this issue of childhood sexual abuse. And I think a lot of us, including speaking for myself, I've noticed over the years that I never even realized how much I really, you know, how much I grieve for it, what I've lost from my experiences as a child. And I'm going to dive into that a little bit more on the way, but I'm going to get into some of the heavy stuff, which we do here at the house first to get you through it. And those are for you who are not familiar with what grief is. Really, grief is just a multifaceted response to loss, particularly to the loss of someone or something which is bond or formed. Although conventionally focused on the emotional response to loss, it is also physical, cognitive, behavioral, social, and physiological dimensions of common to human experience is the loss of something or someone dear to us. There is no right or wrong to grieve, but there are healthy ways to cope with this pain. You can get through it. Grief is expressed and experienced, has a potential for healing, and that eventually can strengthen and enrich your life. Grief is a natural response to loss. It's the emotional suffering you feel when something or someone you've loved is taken away. You might associate grief with death of a loved one, but any loss can cause grief, including relationship breakup, loss of health, loss of your job, loss of financial stability, a miscarriage, death of a pet, a loss of a cherished dream, a loved one's serious illness, a loss of relationship, loss of safety after trauma. And that kind of, the last one I just mentioned, kind of kind of resembles what my experience is, you know, loss of safety after trauma, because basically when my trauma, or rather when my childhood sexual abuse started as a child, I lost all my ability to trust, for one thing, and my ability, therefore, allowing me to grieve in a sense that I'm feeling that I had no one to look over me or and to protect me. You know, something along those lines, anyway, if I'm explaining it correctly, as pertaining to myself. Let me start off with this quote. Grief is like an ocean. It comes in waves, enabling and flowing. Sometimes the water is calm, and sometimes it is overwhelming. We all can do is learn to swim. This is by Vicki Harrison. I mean, I was funny, you know, I'm talking about grief tonight, so I'm looking through, and I know through Twitter feed, I'm always quoting tweets, and you know, it's just a continuous thing that that I like to do. And there's some really, really good quotes out there. Give me another one here. Grief never ends, but it changes. It's possible not to place and stay. Grief is not a sign of weakness nor a lack of faith. It is a piece of love. Let me leave you another one here before I go any further. And this is by Maya Angelou. And I know I see this quote all the time on Twitter, but I saw it, so I thought I would mention it. When I think of death and the late idea has come with alarming frequency, I seem at peace with the idea that a day will dawn when I will no longer be among those living in this valley of strange humors. I can't accept the idea of my own dimension, but I'm unable to accept the death of anyone else. I find it impossible to let a friend or relative go into that country of no return. Disbelief comes my dose, my close companion, and anger follows in the wake, or in its wake. I answer the heretic question, death, where is thy thing? With it, here is my heart and my mind and my memories. And that was by Maya Angelou. And let me see, do I want to do one more? How lucky I am to have something that makes me say, let me start this over again. How lucky am I to have something that makes saying goodbye so hard? And this is by Winnie the Pooh. Who would have guessed? But anyway, folks, grief. You know, it wasn't really till I came to the gatehouse that I really figured out what that was all about. I know what grieving, I kind of had an idea what grieving was about. Well, you know, I do understand the concept of what grief means, especially the definition, whether it be through Wikipedia or through the Webster's Dictionary or something along those lines. But nevertheless, I do understand what grief means and what it represents. You know, growing up and, I know from a very young age, the death of my younger brother, committing suicide. I mean, that was talk about grief there. My grandparents, all my immediate family that were close to me are pretty much gone. So therefore, when I talk about grief, this makes me think of grief and grieving. Although I've never been a really, really good job. I've never ever really done a really good job of grieving over my losses from my past. It wasn't really till I came here that I really kind of figured out how much it really affected me. I guess that's really my point and what I'm getting to, where I figured out, what grief and loss really means to me and how it has affected me. You know, everything from, where my anger sits with me, feeling I'm all alone, my fears of attachment to somebody, knowing that, well, anybody I ever come close to, I'm worried that I'm going to lose them. So having those fears all the time, you know, in the back of my head, were always, always daunting things for me, because I know that as I just stated, that if I got close to somebody, then I'd always have that fear that I'd be losing them. So as far as friendships and I were concerned, for many, many, many years, I never really got close to anybody, because I was always under the belief that, well, if whenever I got close to somebody, I would lose them. So, and that all stems from my childhood sexual abuse. I totally understand that and get that. Before I didn't get that, but now I do get that, and I see where it all comes from. But I'm just telling you my state of mind, where I was at and what I was thinking. And maybe you can relate. I have no idea, but I'm just throwing this out there. And in order to, well, in order to understand it at any level, I mean, I know that I had to reach deep inside me and I had to look at these things. And well, I talked right from the beginning, I talked about the loss of my childhood. Well, that's what I had to deal with first before I dealt with the other things. So the loss of my childhood, well, when I think about it now, and I know when I came here, it was pretty devastating to me in a lot of aspects because, you know, I talked about those other losses on top of that as well. So that just compounded it and made it even worse for myself. And, you know, and I really didn't understand, you know, how much it really affected me until I came here. And yes, I understood what grief was and I understood what loss was, but it didn't really sit with me until I actually started talking about it and made me realize just how much, well, just how much I miss those people, for example, and also, you know, how I missed out on my childhood in many, many aspects, you know. You know, even as a young child, I remember, you know, I mean, granted, yes, I had my time as a child where I played and did things myself. And I know that when I moved out to my grandparents' place, my younger brother and I, my focus was once I got big enough and strong enough as a child, well, from a very young age, I started working. Whether I had a job off the farm or whether I was working on the farm, I always worked from a very, very young age. And I think that was, and that was always, and I would say to this day, obviously that's where I have my work ethics from, is from being able to do that. But there's another little thing I want to throw in there on top of that as well. Yes, that was great that I did that and I was that kind of committed, and that's just the way I was brought up anyway. But at the same time, I basically hid myself in my work. And that was my way of dealing with my grief and my loss and all the other things on top of that, my anger, all sorts of stuff, even though we're only talking about grief right now, but I just threw them in there as well. But nevertheless, that's how I dealt with it. And the more I worked, well, the more I didn't have to think about it. And I never, not like I had to talk about it with anybody, because I wouldn't talk about it with anybody anyway at that time. So nevertheless, you know, time goes on. And of course, well, I found the gatehouse. And this was only the place that I was really able ever to really talk about grief, well, grief and loss, to any level that that I have, that I'm even able to sit here now and even talk about it, to the point where, well, I'm not going to, you know, break down in tears, and I can actually say what I'm feeling and say what I'm thinking and share where it has taken me to where I am today. It hasn't been an easy job at all in any way. You know, and it's easy for me to go back and to think about that stuff I've mentioned about, you know, with the loss of my family, you know, the loss of my childhood, you know, but I choose not to do that nowadays. I spent a lot of time in my past dwelling on that. And once I've learned, you know, how it affected me and what those words really mean to me and to be where I am now in my healing stage, I don't try not to think about that too much. I do, because I have to deal with it at the gatehouse, obviously, and I'm sure in my off times, I have time to myself, which I don't get very often, but when I do, I cherish, and I love that headspace time for myself, where I can think about all kinds of things, including this. But my point being is, what I'm saying is that now, when I think about this stuff, it doesn't own me, is what I'm getting at. And yes, it still makes me sad, but at the same time, it doesn't own me. And there's a huge difference with that, you know, and being able to talk about it and sharing with others and listening to others with very similar experiences is very humbling. You know, and the biggest thing, obviously, well, I'm not alone, as you're not alone out there. I mean, there's so many people out there that are dealing with this experience, and it just, not just with childhood sexual abuse, but grief of a lost one, you know, and even to any of these examples I gave you as well. I mean, there's still a loss, or rather, I mean, it still gives that purpose of grieving, or, you know, or you, well, you know, hoping that a person does, but it's knowing how to grieve, I guess, is what I'm getting at. And what do you do when you do grieve? What do you do? Do you isolate yourself? Do you dissociate? Do you go on a binge, a drinking binge, drug binge? Well, what does a person do to deal with that? Well, I learned, I used to do those things I just mentioned quite extensively. I don't anymore, but I used to do those things, and that was how I numb my pain. And, I mean, the numb the pain of all the other things on top of that, too, but that's how I know that quite frequently through the years prior to me coming to the gatehouse, I often thought about my losses. Yes, my childhood, and I think of the losses of my family, and here I am just, you know, all alone. Poor me. That was my mantra, you know, of being a victim, you know, and that was me, totally me all the way. And now that I've come here and I've learned these things about it, and you know, and at least I can say now that it doesn't own me. I mean, yes, it still will bring tears to my eyes to a certain degree, but the difference is, like I say, it doesn't own me. Everyone grieves differently. Grieving is a personal and highly individual experience. How you grieve depends on many factors, including your personality, your coping style, your life experience, your faith, the nature of your loss. The grieving process takes time. Healing happens gradually. It can't be forced or hurried. There is no normal timetable for grieving. Some people start to feel better in weeks and or months. For others, grieving is a process measured in years, as I described about myself. Whatever you grieve experience, it's important to be patient with yourself and allow the process to naturally unfold. Some points that I should mention. A deep grief an individual experiences following a loss is normal. Grief is a unique experience for every person. Everyone carries with him or herself the capacity to heal. Critical to healing process is having an access to a safe place in which freely to express and explore grief in whatever way makes sense to the person. You know, and these points are brought up are so, so true. You know, when I talked about when my healing, when I came here and where I was able to actually understand what I was actually grieving about, or what I was grieving about, was monumental for me in helping me move forward. You know, I had to let go of those things. You know, it wasn't easy. Well, don't get me wrong. Let me rephrase that. I'm not so much I've let go with them. What I've done is I've done with a lot of my stuff, you know, and I'll talk about, and I'll briefly mention forgiveness, and I'm talking about towards myself, not towards my abusers. And even to bring that on, it's something that I had to put on the shelf where I can see it. I've often I've said this a few times over the course of the year. This is how I've dealt with my, you know, this is where I get forgiveness to come from, where I give an analogy where I put it on a shelf and I don't bury it in a box and put it away. I can't do that because I've done that all my life. Now I've got it on a shelf where I can see it. Okay. This is my analogy, how I look at it and where it doesn't scare me and vice versa. This is where I can look at it every day. And knowing I have to acknowledge that it's there, like all the other things I've got on my shelf, and move on. And this is one of those things that I've done, is I've had to put it on a shelf along with my anger and my trust and all those other things. I've got some busy shelves going on here, I tell you. Lots of stuff going on. But the difference is, like I say, is I didn't put it in a box and put it away. You know, in my healing process, if I had to put it in a box and put it away, I basically would have set myself back 20 years. No, really. But allowing it to, you know, stay on the surface where I can see it has given me great power. And let me explain a little more of that in a little more detail and what I mean by why it's given me great power. Well, it's given me the power to see that does not control me anymore. Like my abusers, like they did for many, many years, even though I was an adult. My abusers controlled me for many, many, many years. For all those fears they installed in me from their grooming, you know, as an example, that was my control for many, many, many years. Now I don't do that. I you know, I'd even put it in a box and I put it away, but every time I turn around, something would happen and then it would jump out of the box and smack me right in the back of the head. Well, this way, by putting it on a shelf, I can see it every day. And I can say hi, and they can say hi back to me. But and the beautiful thing about it is, I've stated from saying this about talking about this analogy, is that it doesn't own me anymore. You know, I look at it every day, And I want to move forward. I don't want it to be a part of my life in a way that it has controlled me in the past. And folks out there, if you're listening, I know that it's quite possible for you too to do the same thing. I'm not saying put it on a shelf like I have, but you know, or do something with it. But it is possible to do something with that, those horrible, horrible things that happened to you in the past, like with myself. And you know, we can't change what happened to us in our past, and we can't. The only thing we can change is our future. And yes, those things happen to us, and yes, they'll always be there. We can never change that. As like with myself, but the difference is, I can put it on a shelf now, and I can look at it, and every day it's not going to go away. The only difference is it doesn't own me, and that's huge. That to me, that's very, very huge. You know, it's nice to wake up in the morning and to be able to go, you know, make myself a cup of coffee, you know, go outside, watch the sun come up. You know, that's really, really nice to actually feel that, and not to have those other things, you know, in front of me where I can't enjoy it, where it was for many, many, many years, well, pretty much all my life, you know, and it's nice way to say that, that doesn't own me anymore. And I can actually, you know, I can look at it and I could tell it to, you know, to F off, you know, it's not going to control me like it did. But I had to learn these things, as you might have to do the same thing, learning to find a new way of coping versus, you know, addictions, for example, as I did. That's how I dealt with that was how I coped, was with my addictions. And, you know, self-sabotage, you know, all those nasty, nasty, nasty things. But learning these things, you know, it wasn't easy. It took a lot of practice, and it wasn't months. It was actually years, and I'm still learning it. You know, if you saw me, 5 years ago, even 5 years ago, after me being here 2 years already. I mean, I was different 2 years being in here already. I was already facilitating and I was already giving back, but I was still healing in the same process. You know, it's really, really good that the Gatehouse gives us this opportunity, you know. I mean, obviously it's their decision on whether they think that you're capable or whether you have the capacity to go out there and do that and to give back, because the idea is, as I've explained this in the past, about your role as a facilitator versus a participant. Well, you know, I came in as a participant, and where I got to find my voice, and as a facilitator, your idea is to help the participants find their voice. But at the same time, my point I'm getting at is that where being a facilitator helped me was I'm able to hear more other stories. I hear other stories and how, you know, I've watched them grow, and I listen to what they've done to change their thought process to help them heal and move forward. And again, like I say, I can't emphasize enough on this how horribly hard it was. Well, I wouldn't say horribly hard. That may be a terrible choice of words, but it was incredibly hard, incredibly, incredibly hard. And it's something I had to learn, and I had to stay with it. It's kind of like joining a team, and you know, you join a team and you're there until it's done. And it's the same thing in your healing process. I had to do the same thing. I had to learn, and I had to sit, and I had to listen, and you know, drop, you know, say something sometimes, and you know, and offer my own experience as well as part of being a facilitator. But being able to sit there and listen, me listening there to other people's stories and what they're doing and watching them grow was very, very helpful for me. You know, and the biggest thing, obviously, is I'm not alone. Okay, but sitting in a group with a bunch of men, or in some cases or other, and even cases where I sat in groups with men and women both. And I really feel it's very, very important. I don't care whether you're a man or a woman. And, you know, I mean, if you are a woman and you're abused by a man, and if you're a man and you're abused by a woman, well, think about that example I just gave you. Now, look at both sides. I mean, obviously, we're different. You know, there's no question about that. At the same time, yes, we're different, but we also think differently. And we also react differently. I'm not going to minimize one or the other, but because they're both equally as devastating. And that really needs to be recognized. But our healing process obviously are different, and how we act and talk to are obviously different as well. But I'm getting at is hearing their experiences and what they've done. This is what I love about women talking and their experiences is, you know, they're so resilient and they do look at things so much differently than what us men do. You know, women, for the most part, they do. And I love how they find resolve for themselves, you know, once they figure things out. And then, you know, in some ways, I'm not saying it's this way for all, but like in some cases I've heard, and they make it sound, well, I won't say that it's more simple or simpler, but they just, well, actually, I think that what I'm looking for to say here is that they have such a loving thought and touch behind it towards themselves, more so than what a man would do. A man is more, you know, obviously we're more aggressive and even in our thoughts. So, but for us to, you know, to come down to that level and to be sensitive and to recognize those feelings like a woman would do, far greater than what a man could do. I know that already, and I don't need to explain that already. And you women out there know that already. You understand that stuff much better than what men do. And there's a lot to be learned from that. And this is my point I'm trying to make. And this is where being in a co-ed group, listening to other women and their experiences has helped me immensely. And I was abused on both sides. So I have really no reason to trust anybody as far as I'm concerned, whether it be a man or a woman, as far as I'm concerned. But that's not what I'm talking about now. This is just part of the example I'm talking about understanding one another and our differences in our healing. But I do love the fact that I get to sit in co-ed groups, which we have what we call the phase two groups, and I get to hear insight from women. It is so, so important in regards. It's been so helpful in my healing recovery as well. You know, I need to understand, and I need to understand, you know, maybe not so much the twisted side, but I need to understand, you know, just, I guess, forgive my analogy I use here, the meat and potatoes of it, or the guts of it, or the complicated pieces of it. I need to understand that in order for me to help process what I'm thinking inside and what I may believe, whether it be true or false. Again, that's irrelevant, but it's about what I believe and understanding from the other side what's actually going on. And to me, that was so important. And I've seen this 100 times now, you know, more than 100 times, a few hundred times now, or I've gone in the groups, and it's so vitally important to have women. You know, where it's co-ed like that, it's so, so important. I've seen it help so many people. It helps each side understand what they're feeling. You know, obviously, it really depends on their experiences. But nonetheless, it is so important in your healing process. It wasn't mine, and I've seen it that way and others as well. One of the most common questions survivors of sexual violence ask is, will the pain ever end? When you're dealing with the events of your past, the pain can seem overwhelming and never-ending. Survivors are left to cope with a lot of grief, overwhelming and never-ending. Survivors are left with, here where I'm lost already. Will you ever get your life back? Will you ever reclaim your old you, whatever the old you was? Will you ever sleep without nightmares or have a carefree day? The answer is yes. But there is a process of grieving that most survivors go through, as I've been kind of describing as I've been going along. It may also help to consider your stages are common to sexual abuse survivors and all these experiencing grief. You may not experience all these stages, which I'm about to read to you, and you may not experience them all in this order. You might even go back a stage or two as new memories surface or you deal with new emotions. However, it can help to identify where you are in the process of recovery and to see each stage not as a conclusion. That's important now. Remember, it's not a conclusion, but as a step in the journey of your recovery. Okay, well, one of the first things that which I can certainly relate to, which right off the hop I can say, is that shock and denial. Well, I certainly had the shock, and as far as denial is concerned, well, I can't say that I have all that, but I had the shock of actually what happened to me, or actually, well, what my shock turned out to be was my complex PTSD, and that's what my shock, and that's something that I still carry today, and I honestly believe that it is better than what it used to be because I don't get as many nightmares as I used to get. I don't. I don't flashback as much as I used to, and I think it's all attributed. Granted, I've not gone to a therapist. I haven't done any type of therapy. I've just basically talked about my experiences and the trouble. And what I've done is I've talked about my experiences, well, more times than I can even, you know, between my both hands and my toes. I just couldn't count how many times I've talked about my experiences now. So I honestly believe, and the research that I've done regarding post-traumatic stress or complex post-traumatic stress, either side, they're very similar, but there is differences if you go online and or if you know the difference. But there is a huge difference between both of them. But nevertheless, they're still both they're both horrible things to live with. And anyway, after experiencing sexual violence, there's such total confusion and disbelief that a person often goes numb. The mind-body system has to shut down. It is also common for a survivor to deny what happened was rape or abuse, or downplay it. It wasn't so bad. I've heard it so many times, and I've never... Well, you know what? I think I might have downplayed it many, 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 many years ago, but I know later on in life, after I got married and I had a kid and stuff like that, there was no denying or minimizing it. I just couldn't talk about it to anybody. And to me, that's just as bad, I guess, any way you look at it. But nevertheless, not having a voice and not being able to talk about it was bad. But when we downplay it or say it wasn't so bad, well, how can a person's, you know, I mean, I shouldn't say, or rather, let me rephrase this. It's hard for a person, you know, I can't really relate to me saying and minimizing it or doing it like that maybe I did that many, many years ago, but even before I came to the house, I've certainly never denied it, and I certainly never dismissed it. Although I think I might have tried to a couple of times, and my anger sort of just displaced that totally right off the bridge. So I had to, you know, I couldn't deny it. I mean, it happened. Why do I have these nightmares? How can I deny that? How can I deny waking up in the middle of the night and, you know, trigger warning here. How can I wake up in the middle of the night and from a effing nightmare that I've had for 20 some odd years, longer than that, the same nightmare over and over again where I'm being dragged into a basement and where I've been violated. So that same nightmare that's from my very first abuser too, by the way. I had that nightmare for many, many years. I haven't had that nightmare in quite a while now, thank God. But I had that nightmare for so long. And how can this is my example. I don't know what your experience out there, but this was my example of how the hell can I deny something like that? And then I can remember like it was yesterday, you know, step by step, the stairs, the smell, everything. It was just like it was yesterday. And this is over 50 years ago now. Or around 50 years ago now, I should say. Not over 50 years, but around 50 years ago now. And I can still remember it to this day, like it clear as a bell. It'd be like me going outside in the springtime and smelling the smell of the, you know, the snow melting you know, those kind of smells, you know, to give you a better idea. Like that's how fresh and clear it was in my mind. So it's not so easy to, well, for me, it wasn't so easy to dismiss it or to minimize it, even though I tried many, many years ago to do so. Like it never happened to me. Well, if that was the case, then why do I have these nightmares? Why do I have the fear of trust? Why am I so angry? Why are all these things happening to me? Obviously, those are attachments to my grief. But nevertheless, that happened to me. And I can't deny it. You know, that's my experience relating to the first stage of the seven stages. Okay? The second stage. Fear, panic, and shame. What do I do now? Once the shock wears off, you're no longer numb. There are some predictable next steps, such as profound anxiety and vulnerability. How will I survive this loss of innocence and violation? Facing my friends and family, living my life again. There's a mounting sense of being out of control, which for many survivors also evokes feelings of shame, inadequacy, and this lack of control, not surprisingly, can make the memory of sexual violence even worse. as I've kind of been saying already. A violinist may feel like his or her life is over, like the spirit has died. The effects of sexual violence are long-lasting. Yes, well, you know, long-lasting meaning a lifetime. You know, it's obviously just what we do with it, but that's what it is for me. Okay, this is very important here too. I just love, this is a really, really good example, rather. This, you gotta listen to this part. Number three, rage and or helplessness. How dare someone do this to me? Often people in the phase swing between rage and profound sadness. Both states can be induced by deep underlying vulnerability or helplessness. You've been wounded, feel exposed, or just want to lash out. Or you turn the rage inward in depression and self-hatred. Now it is crawling under the covers of escapism, or going through the motions of living, or even staying as hard as you can regain victorious over the basic unworthiness. The battle of a fear or failure or lurking dread of being sucked into a compelling black hole of helplessness. Thought only person responsible for sexual violence is the perpetrator, many survivors are likely to over-attribute some self-responsibility. This is to blame themselves for what happened. It is often easier to try to blame yourself than to understand why someone else would even hurt another person the way you've been hurt. That's why the next phase, while often maddening, is also essential for moving through the grieving process. So, when I talked about number three, when it really hits a chord with me, I can kind of appreciate this in a lot of ways. I can understand the rage part of it. I can certainly understand the helplessness part of it, because never mind the denial, which we've already kind of covered and talked about already. But, you know, if you're feeling like that and you know outright that it's happened, and you feel it in your body, it's really, really hard to, you know, hard to ignore it, you know, especially if it's overtaking your body and many, many different ways. And sorry, folks, I didn't mean to say it in this manner, a little triggering, but that's kind of what it does to a person. It overtakes your mind and wants to control what you feel and think, and, you know, wants you to feel sad and hopelessness and all those sort of nasty things. Okay, number four, guilt and oblivion. Damn if you do or if you don't. The feelings of old voices of guilt and shame, violating or compromising an internalized core value or essential part of your self-identity, integrity, and self and esteem, can become louder and more incensed. Self-directed rage keeps taunting you for shortcomings, unworthiness, etc., etc., and can ultimately drain you. It is at this stage that many survivors wonder if the pain will ever end. You might be part of a support group engaged in therapy, journaling about your assault, but feel nothing like nothing is helping. At this point, it is important to reach out and hold on to hope. It will get better. And yes, that sometimes will happen. And I'll give you an example of that right now where that happened to me. I remember I did my phase one. I came back and I started that. There's a phase two program. At that time, it was only an 8-week program. Now it's 15 weeks, or rather 16 weeks. And one of the first things I said to my facilitators was, I'm really, really doubtful this is going to help. And I don't know. I guess that day that I went in there to go and start this thing, after I did my phase one, I think I sat at home for, it was about 3 months before I came back here. And I think I was spiraling down again a little bit. So therefore I had that bit of reservation when I came in. But little did I realize that when I started it, how empowering and self-empowering it was for me to actually dive back into what I was actually holding on to, which was really not allowing me to move forward. You know, it was great when I came the first time. I was able to discover what was going on, but what you know, I was processing it and figured out all these things, but what the hell am I supposed to do with it now? Well, I didn't realize I was supposed to let it go. Well, let it go, but in a way like I've described in the beginning of my show, like which I've done with my stuff. You know, instead of being, you know, letting it run my life, I eventually put it on the shelf. You know, where, you know, I can't deny that it didn't happen, and I can't minimize it. I can't change anything. But the difference is, like I've stated earlier, that I put it on a shelf and I don't have to, it doesn't own me. And that's what I had to learn how to do when I went into the phase two. I had to, you know, what we terminalize around here as, or rather what we call stuckness. I was stuck. I guess just plain simple as that, I was stuck. And I did not know what to do with it. So I had to learn, as you will have to do too out there, if you haven't dealt with this in any way, find a way to deal with it that you can, you know, that you can get by day by day and whatever capacity you're capable of doing. It's just learning to do this is very, very hard. It was for me, as I've stated many times. But that first 8 weeks was very, very well. I needed that because it helped me so much. It helped me understand that by holding on to my past as I was at the level that I was, I just had to find a way. You know, I keep giving you the analogy of how I put it on the shelf. Well, that's just what I've done with it. I've heard many other different versions of what people do with their stuff that they've had to deal with all their life. Well, that's just my example. But till I figured that out, it was a bit of a bumpy road, you know, like 10 steps forward, 5 steps backwards, back and forth for quite a few times. But honestly, it does get better. I'm just having a sip of a drink here, but it does get better. But I had to work on it. I had to work on it and work on it and work on it. You're talking about a dude here that was stuck with something for a long, long, long time. So therefore, I had to work extra hard because I still think that the longer you've been stuck with something like that, the harder it is. Well, I won't say it's like that for everybody, but I think it's generally harder for people that have been stuck with it. The longer you're stuck with something like that, the harder it is for you to get over it. Well, not so much get over it, but to deal with it is what I'm trying to say. Whatever capacity you're able to do. And I'm not saying that everybody's like that. I'm certainly not saying that at all. But I'm just saying that from my own experience, and my own healing experience, what I've seen from others from my age and older. And again, I'm not saying this is like that for everybody. I'm not saying that at all. And who am I to say that anyway? But only from my experience that I've seen this. And I've noticed that with people my age and older, no disrespect there by saying so, but for my case, for example, well, I've been holding on to it for so long, and I really need to work hard to put it on the shelf, as I keep talking about. And that is not easy at all. It wasn't easy whatsoever. Checking my. But once you discover something that actually works for you, you know, then you keep pushing. And one thing I should also mention too as well, I know that for a lot of people, and even for myself, I had to try a lot of different things to see what worked for me. And after a while, the things that were working for me that didn't work for me anymore, I had to find something else. So it's a constant. It was a constant battle to find things to help me help keep me grounded, or to implement pause for myself. To be mindful of what I'm thinking and doing. And whenever I went into a hole, I had to learn different ways of crawling out of that hole. You know, I always didn't have a rope. I didn't always have a ladder. You know, sometimes I have to dig my own way out. I mean, I had to do it many, many different ways to find my way out of that hole. So the process of healing, not only has it been quite a journey, but it's been a lot of work. because I've had to constantly try to find things to change my to change my idea that I wasn't as bad as I thought I was, and I needed to, you know, to keep reminding myself if I everything from keeping inanimate objects in my pocket to ground myself, to going for walks, motorcycle rides, anything at all, to try to change my thought process, so I wouldn't fall back in that hole of darkness that I keep talking about. Okay, number five, focused anger and letting go, finding the good out from the bad. To reach that powerful, purposeful, and passionate state of focused anger, a survivor must often blend rage and sadness. Some rage can propel us out of the shocked and paralyzed or oblivious state, yet you must also face your sadness and loss and struggle with uncertainty to temper uncontrollable aggressions, to make a sadder yet wiser assessments and decisions. If you've worked hard to integrate the previous stages and then the reward is focused anger, what happened to me was terrible and wrong, but there's another side. You're ready to loosen that knot of hurt and pain. You're ready to see that while you might never be the person you were before, you are now stronger, wiser, and capable of reclaiming your voice and your life. This is a stage survivors frequently start using their experiences to help others. For instance, speaking out or volunteering at a rape crisis center. It's kind of like what I was just saying. And by me facilitating and hearing other people's stories, and then I'm still working on my shit as well. So it worked out perfectly. It was a two-way street. You know, I'm helping you find your voice, and you're helping me still find my voice. So it's a two-way street. You know, and this is the beautiful thing about peer support, is that, you know, it's not just your story, it's everybody's story. And that is that was so important in my healing. You know, I mean, obviously, again, like, I can't say this enough, obviously we're not alone, but be able to be in a group of people, whether it be men or women or both, and hear their experiences, it is it was so helpful. I can't say enough about that in regards to on how it helped me in my healing process. Okay, number six, exploration and new identity, or going from victim to survivor to thriver. Letting go is often unnerving. You've invested so much into your simple surviving, you might feel like being a survivor is the only thing that defines you. But at this stage, you are incorporated what happened into your life. It is not who you are, but just part of who you are. You're likely to find that you think about what happened a lot less and feel more like a stronger version of the old you, whatever the hell that was. Or, you know, the vulnerable yet fluid state provides unprecedented opportunities to get to know yourself, to assess your true individuality, strengths and weaknesses, and not only as it releases to the sexual abuse. Now is the time for a full-scale person in situation life intervention inventory. How healthy or toxic are seemingly vital relationships and friendships? What about your health? During this transitional window, to do dysfunctional coping patterns, habits of drinking and smoking, drugging, eating, lack of exercise, limited socializing, or spiritual support need to be challenged. What do you need to truly move forward? And, you know, it's funny, I'm talking about this now, and when I went into the phase two, I needed to ask those questions to myself. What the hell am I going to do to change some of these things? Because at that time I was still drinking, and I was still in addictions, not at the capacity that I was. In fact, I know when I started the phase two, that's when I realized that I had to quit. I had to quit doing drugs, because if I couldn't, I was getting there, and I cut back, but cutting back really didn't do it. I had to quit. I had to quit completely because I wasn't getting all the pieces. And when I figured out that it was the drugs that were adhering to that problem, then I had to get off of them. And once I did that, then my healing recovery basically sped up a little bit. Well, actually a lot. And it changed things profoundly. You know, being able to, being able to feel something and then being able to process it and actually understanding what I'm thinking and feeling is so beneficial to anybody, actually, when it comes to your healing is concerned. But for me, it was a challenge, because when I drug myself, it's kind of hard to focus on a feeling when you think you're numb, but you're not numb, or whatever you might be thinking at the time. So to alter that false perception of reality, which was mine at the time, I needed to stop doing drugs completely, and just feel it all the way through, whether I wanted to or not. I had to feel the pain. I couldn't numb it. I had to understand the feelings of the stuckness I talked about earlier when I started phase two, and I had to really, really learn this was what was going on. And this is where I was able to change that. When I quit the drugs, I was actually able to focus. Well, instead of focusing at 90%, I was able to focus at 120%. That's a huge difference. So I was able to put more effort into my own healing process. So all that was beneficial to me. Very, very beneficial for me. And I would recommend it to anybody out there who's struggling, if you're struggling into capacity, as I've just described for myself, then I would really, really recommend you do that. Because if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be where I am now today, for sure. I probably could have stayed back. I probably would have done the 8 weeks. And I can't predict what I could have done in the future, but I could have very easily slid back. And, who knows what I could have done to myself. I have no idea. But it wouldn't have been pretty in regards to how I would have taken care of myself. In other words, I'd still be, I'd still be stuck. I guess it's really the best, is really the course of word, course of words that I'm looking for, is I'd still be stuck. And I would not have moved forward. I would not have the capacity to do what I'm doing now. There's no way I could have done what I could do what I'm doing now. I don't even know sometimes how the hell I do what I do. But I could not do that with drugs in my path. I could not. No way. Alcohol too. And any kind of, anything you ingest in your body to alter your perception of reality, that just doesn't work with me. I could not focus and move forward. But when I did, it was beautiful. It was a beautiful thing. I learned so much about myself. I'm not saying I enjoyed all of what I learned about myself, but nonetheless, I needed to learn these things in order to move forward. Number seven, which is kind of what I'm talking about now, is in some strange ways, I'm talking about acceptance. So number seven is acceptance. While submerging yourself in the stages of grief for a time will feel hellish. It sure was. There's truly an opportunity for a rebirth. Getting out of the black box is a distinct possibility if you can ride on the ride out of this acutely emotional learning roller coaster. The grief encounter is definitely more than a learning curve, and there is no absolute or fixed period of time for your movement to through these stages. The most important thing we can do while we're healing or in grieving is to take the time to gradually recover and discover, as I've talked about, who am I? Yeah, really, who am I? What genuinely feels like me? Yeah, what am I? All those questions. What works for me and my family? What seems to be kindle or rekindles my passion? Remember, there's a real difference between feeling sorry for yourself and feeling sorrow. When you are feeling sorry for yourself, you are mostly blaming others. When you are feeling sorrow, you are demonstrating the courage to face your fears and pain. There are poignant moments in your life when we all must take the time to embrace our sorrow. Well, I don't know if any out there can relate to what I'm talking about, but those are the seven stages of grief. And I'll state this again. It doesn't mean that you're going to have all those seven stages, or you're going to have any of them, or you could have little bits and pieces of them. All I know is that through those seven stages, I have little bits and pieces of that are basically attached to me. And being able to understand that at whatever capacity you're able to do so will be very, very helpful. and you're moving forward for your recovery. You know, I've often talked about having some kind of spiritual connection, whether it be with God or with Allah or, you know, with whomever, whatever your spiritual path is concerned. And I know that when I came here, I didn't pray to anybody. I didn't do anything. And I really didn't believe in all that stuff because a lot of it, as far as trust is concerned, in regards to the church and all that sort of stuff, kind of was blown out to sea with me because of all the stuff that I heard that had happened and other men that I've met been through the same experience. So, and I don't know, I won't get into too long about my story about why I didn't believe in God and that sort of stuff. But anyway, I had to find a spiritual path. My path was I would do for myself is I would pray to the Creator. So you can define that in any way you like, but that was my choice. This is what I did for my recovery regarding finding a spiritual path. So I would pray to the Creator. I kind of believe what the natives believe in, or the indigenous people of our country. And why I say that, I won't get into a long story about this, and we're not here to talk about this, but just so you have a better understanding where I'm coming from, is that, well, when they pray to the universe, they pray to the earth, they pray to the trees, and all that sort of stuff. The only difference is they don't put a label on it like us, we have done, like God or Allah or anything like that. That's the only difference. They haven't done that. And to me, at that time, that seemed to be the most logical path for me to go because, the Creator has never let me down. The earth hasn't let me down. The only people that let me down are my abusers and whatever. Those are the people that let me down. The plants and the trees and the water, the air, all that stuff. So, I mean, that may seem kind of crazy saying the way I'm saying it, but it's really, really the reality of it all. I mean, how could I blame that stuff for what I've been through? But that was my mindset at the time. I needed to find something that would help me with my grounding, and that's what I did to help me with myself. Which brings me on to what I'm talking about, a spiritual grieving, a grief process. One way to stop One way to stop reacting out of our inner child, or rather inner children, is to release the stored emotional energy from our childhoods by doing the grief work that will heal our wounds. The only effective long-term way to clear our emotional process is to clear our inner channel, to the truth, which exists in all of us, is to grieve the wounds and the losses which we suffered as children and continue to suffer as adults. An important tool to which may be vital in changing our behavior patterns and attitudes is the healing transformation, is the grieving process. We're all carrying around repressed pain, terror, shame, rage, energy from our childhoods. Whether it be 20 years ago or 50 years ago, as I've talked about for myself, we all have a grieving energy within us, even if we came from a relatively healthy family, because this society is emotionally dishonest and dysfunctional. In order to do the inner child work, we need to be willing to do the grief work. Emotions are the energy, and that energy needs to be released. Maybe through crying or raging, we need our own feelings about what happened to us. We need to own our right to be angry that our needs were not met. Grief is an energy that needs to be released. We need to give ourselves permission to feel our pain, our sadness, and our rage. We need to own and honor our feelings. Part of the grief simply owns the sadness and the anger. We need to own the grief about what happened to us as children. And we also need to own the grief over that effect it has on us as an adult. Most importantly, as an adult. We start understanding the cause and the effect of relationship between what happened to the child that we were and the effect it had on the adult we became. We can truly start to forgive ourselves. It is only when we start understanding on an emotional level, on a gut level, that we were powerless to do anything differently than we did, that we can truly start to truly love ourselves. The deep grieving work is an energy work. Once we can get it out of our heads and start paying attention to what is happening in our body, then we can start releasing the emotional energy. Own your voice, own your child's voice. For some, grieving may take this form. When we get to a place where emotions are coming up, then the voice starts breaking and remember to keep breathing. We automatically stop breathing and close our throats when the feelings get close to the surface. It's kind of like running and holding your breath. You know, you got to breathe in order to feel what's going on. And if you don't, you're just going to drop there on the spot. So what I'm just saying is you need to do these things in order to let these things happen to your body so it can be released. Own your voice, own your child's voice. At the point of the technique is to locate where the energy is concentrated in the body. It can be in any place from head to feet. Much of the time it is in our back because that is where we carry stuff we don't want to look at, which makes perfect sense. Or in an area of the solar plexus, anger or fear or the heart chakra, pain, broken heart or chest, sadness. The individual breaths directly into these places and into that place. Visualize breathing a white light into the part of the body that starts breaking up the energy and little pieces of energy that start getting released. These balls of energy are sobs or tears. This is a terrifying place to be for the ego because it feels out of control. It is a wonderful place to be from the healing perspective. Empowering the healing is going to with the flow. Excuse me. Inhale the white light, exhale the sobs, tears, snot from the nose, all forms of energy being released. You can be the witness watching yourself and controlling the process at the same time you are in pain of releasing it. By controlling the process, you are choosing to align yourself with the energy flow, surrounding to the flow instead of shutting down as the terrified ego wants to do. It is very hard to learn the process without a safe place to do it, like I have here at the Gatehouse, and someone who knows that what you're doing is to facilitate it, to make sure that you're safe. Once you have learned to do it, then it is possible to facilitate your own grieving process. So if you ever do this and you're by yourself, I really wouldn't recommend it, especially if you're dealing with some really, really heavy stuff. Really recommend that you have somebody around that you trust or, you know, just till you do it once or twice until you get it out of your system. Okay. Let's identify some losses now. You know, we kind of briefly, we talked about it in the beginning. In the process of telling your story and exploring your emotions, you may have already identified the losses that resulted from the abuse. These may include the loss of connections with family members or friends, opportunity to parent or grandparents, spirituality, as I just mentioned, feeling far away from or angry towards God, as I described about myself, relationships with your partner, self-esteem or having a low opinion of yourself, dreams, goals, or vision of your life. The losses experienced or experiencing as a result of the abuse are real. Minimizing or denying them all will only slow down your healing process. Identifying, acknowledging these losses is an important step towards healing. Although this is a difficult step, you may feel a certain amount of relief when you are able to put the name on to the losses you've experienced. So when I in the beginning or throughout the process of my evening here tonight, I've talked about how I put my stuff on my shelf. See, this is my way of looking at it and not dismissing it. And, it's in my face every day, so I can't really ignore it. But obviously, it's what I do with it every day. So by leaving it in the shelf, it allows me to look at it and it's not threatening anymore. And it's not, it doesn't control me like it used to. So It's where it ought to be, on the shelf, where I can see it, and as long as it doesn't fall off the shelf and smack me in the side of the head and put me back to where I was, that's all that matters. But I really don't I don't want that to happen. I don't. It's not going to happen, and I'm going to keep moving forward. But at the same time, with saying that, that the possibility is always there. But I don't want to go there. That isn't a possibility because I'm not going to go there. It's just that, well, simple, but not. There's a lot of freedom by putting it on a shelf like that. A lot of freedom. And it's allowed me to do so many things by putting it on a shelf, whereas before I wouldn't. I mean, before, obviously, as I've described throughout through the show this evening, I would have isolated, dissociated, and I would have got back into my addictions just as easily, just to deal with it. Accepting loss. After you've identified and acknowledged your losses, deciding to accept and resolve them is even the next step. The decision to accept and resolve the losses you've identified above is a decision to grieve them, and the decision to grieve your losses is a decision to feel the pain. That's stuff I've been kind of talking about. Our culture minimizes our grief by either denying it or promoting quick ways to deal with it. Neither of these strategies work well because they're not only is grief, it is real, it is a process. Making the reality of grief and the pain does not alleviate the suffering experienced. Your losses are real, your grief is real, your pain is real, your ability to move through the grieving process and experience healing is equally real. So being able to feel that and to move forward, it's just equally, your ability. If you're able to do that, you're able to move forward is kind of what we're saying. And I'm a good example of that. The grief process rarely moves in a linear fashion. Grief tends to move in cycles, alternately intensifying and diminishing. Each person works through their grief process differently, some more quickly than others, as I've stated. The intensity of the feelings are also varies from person to person. People who have the support of family and friends are often able to move through this process of dealing with the reality of grief and loss. However, the family and friends aren't always willing or able to lend support to someone grieving, experiencing grief. There's also times when people get stuck somewhere in the grief cycle and find themselves unable to complete the process. This is when the aid of a trained counselor or support group is recommended. As you move through the grieving process, it will be helpful for you to gather support from others, to be patient with yourself, to give yourself time and space to work through the process, to understand that each person's journey is unique, and to know that the pain will diminish over time. Okay, now we're going to get tough. Now we're going to talk about anger work a little bit, which is really directly related to this as well. This is also an energy flow process. Process of a bat, tennis racket, pillow, whatever, is lifted over the head of you as you inhale, and then you hit the pillow and you expel all the energy in a shout or a grunt or, even an FU, a scream. Whatever words come out of you, exhale, open your throat and say whatever needs to be said. It's vitally important for all of us to own our right to be angry without what happened to us or about the ways we were deprived. If we do not own our right to be angry about what happened in childhood, it greatly impairs our ability to set boundaries as an adult. And that is so, so true. We need to own our and release our anger and rage at our abusers, our parents, our teachers, our ministers, or other authority figures, including the concept of God that we have believed in while we were growing up. We do not necessarily need to vent anger directly at them, but we need to release the energy. We need to let that child in us scream, I hate you, I hate you. while we beat on the pillows or something such or something like that, because that is how a child expresses anger. You know, this is another topic, but I mean, we always deal with the inner child, and this sort of stuff comes up as well when we talk about the inner child. For some, the anger work will need to come back, will need to come before the grief work. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, depending on how angry you are, you may need to deal with your anger before you deal with your grief. I know at the house, we will deal with anger first before we deal with grief. Because anger is, I don't know, it's probably in the top three, actually the top two. if I'm looking at feelings and emotions that affect us, to any great degree, and anger is in the top two, in my opinion anyway. You need a strong desire to heal and patience. Recognize the cost of staying bitter. You fuel your bitterness by thinking about your abuser and the ways he or she could damage, he or she damaged your life, as I talked about for myself. This keeps the focus on your past rather than on your present. Staying bitter keeps you mentally connected to the person you did not want in your life to begin with. Decide that you want to heal. Ask yourself if you are ready to do what it takes to serve this connection with your abuser so you can free yourself from your past. Choose to think about positive things each time your abuser crosses your mind. Think about something that makes you happy instead. Choose a channel your mental energy towards something that brings you joy rather than sorrow. Process painful emotions as they arise. You do not have to ignore your pain to forgive. You keep your focus on healing, your pain instead on hating your abuser. Become indifferent to your abuser. As you invest your mental energy into hating your abuser, you will find yourself becoming indifferent toward him. While most people think of hate as the opposite of love, the true opposite is indifference. Here's a few tips and strategies for moving forward. And the term of forgiveness is a stumbling block. Think of the process of letting go of the bitterness. So I know that forgiveness is a huge topic around the house, and I know it was for me. I mean, hell, even on Twitter, I'm known as Unforgiven. You know, I've always said that, well, I certainly won't forgive my abusers, but primarily my focus is once I forgive myself, then I can truly move forward to what the universe has in store for me. If I stay in the bitterness, then the universe will only give me my abuser day to day. And that is not living. That is not what life's supposed to be about. To me, that's just another form of control or narcissism or whatever you want to call it. And that person is not even in your life anymore. So something to think about. In the term, forgiveness is not one-time choice, but a series of choices. The redirects from focus away from your past. Forgiveness is not the same thing as a pardon. If the other person is not harmed you, then there would be no need to forgive. Exactly. It's that simple. And reconciliation is not required to forgive. Your abuser does not even need to know that you have the chosen to let go of your bitterness. And finally, finding a quality of therapist with experience in counseling with your abuse history is an important part of your healing childhood abuse. A therapist can help you work through the process of forgiving your abuser. And one last thing. With forgiveness, your victim identity dissolves and your true power emerges, the power of presence. Instead of blaming the darkness, you bring into the light. Paul.
How are you doing? I just thought I'd bring you a coffee.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you.
No problem. Some good heavy mud.
Oh, it just sounds like some good heavy mud. No. How are you doing tonight? How are things around the house tonight?
I'm running a group tonight. A new group. This is the second one we've done called Excited to be Moving Forward.
Okay.
And that's for people who've done phase one and phase two.
Okay.
And had a little break. And then, you know, how do we move forward after that?
So, yeah.
Yeah. And so this, we're just tonight, it's 7 weeks and it's in 2 week increment. Sorry.
Increment. Yeah.
And the reason we did that is because after we did the first 4 week program, one of the feedback we had is there wasn't enough discussion time. So now we bring up the subject. So the first subject last week was pause, gratitude, and self-care.
Mm-hmm.
And so that week we did some exercises and we did a mindfulness exercise. And then this week we're just discussing it all. So we sent them away with homework to show during this week, write down in your journals how pause, gratitude, and self-care has affected you and where you've used it. And now we're just discussing that for the first time.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, so
that's really awesome.
Then next week it's going to be positive self-talk, being your own cheerleader.
Wow.
And then we'll have 2 weeks of that. And then the last week, the last 2 week segment, so weeks 5 and 6, is going to be about having those tough conversations. I know what a lot of survivors, including myself, from what I've got from sitting in these rooms, have a hard time doing.
Mm. Yeah, and I was kind of touching base on that tonight about being able to be, vulnerable and authentic with yourself, and it's not an easy thing to do.
No.
And this is the beauty thing about what you guys have started now. I mean, the Gatehouse has many, many programs now. We do a lot of different things, and we keep expanding on personal growth in many, many different ways. And one of the biggest things we want people to do when we come here, obviously to heal is obviously the most important thing. But after you've done your, the phase one program and the phase two program, well, what about after that? Well, we've always had support here, even after they've done. But now what we've done, the Gatehouse has done, is they expanded their programs. And this is just another example of an expanded program. So we have a drop-in on Thursday where you can come in. You can still get support.
Mm-hmm.
You can call the house if you want to.
We got our care.
And we have support here all the time.
Yeah.
But this is just another part of an extension of what the Gatehouse is offering now to help you with your healing process. And this is absolutely wonderful.
I just love it because, it's a real authentic, deep discussion on how are we moving forward and how can we move forward.
Yeah.
We don't use the stuck word.
Yeah.
We don't use all that. At one point we were like,
I was using it.
How do we get unstuck?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's a valid word. But we've decided, instead of that, how are we going to move forward? And so one of my last questions to the group was, how do you see pause and gratitude helping you move forward?
Mm.
So anyway, I got to run back to my group.
Great. Thank you for
being here. Great show tonight. Thanks very much for all you do, Stuart.
Yeah, thank you. Likewise, Paul.
All right. We'll see you soon.
Thank
Enjoy
you.
The mud.
Yeah, thanks.
Bye, people.
That was Paul. Tom Bobby brought me a nice cup of mud, and Paul is the men's coordinator program for the men's. Paul is the coordinator for the men's program here at the Gatehouse, and he is also a coordinator for the Phase 2 program, which we have in place as well. So Paul is a pretty very, very busy person around here, and Paul is an employee of the Gatehouse as well. Wonderful of him to come by. Wow, time is moving by. Well, you know what? I'm going to pretty much leave it at that, and I'm going to give you some self-care things to take home with you. Hopefully you can take care of yourself in that way. I mean, your self-care is most important. I know whether you go for a walk or, don't buy that bag of chips or that box of ice cream, even though that would be really, really good. Healthy but unhealthy, but a good healthy walk or something like that. But what you could do for self-care, read a good book, talk to your partner, reconnect with your family, eat a decent meal, recognize your hunger, really recognize your hunger. But, I made reference to a bag of chips and ice cream, which is really, really yummy. Mainly the ice cream I'm talking about. And I'm not really a chip person, but I really like the ice cream. But eating something good, something good for your body, like some fruit or something like that, which is not half bad either. A journal. Listen to some really good music. Take a hot bath. As long as it's self-care for you, where if you're feeling a little bit out of sorts, then these little things will help you, regenerate yourself and bring you back to, bring you back to the now or to present. Okay, so I think I've pretty much covered that. I don't know if I talk about it anymore. I'm beating it crazy here anyway. I guess the most important thing I can do now is say thank you. Thank you for listening. And I have a couple of guests lined up. And I can't say who they are right at the moment because they haven't given me the time that they're going to come in. So I'm hoping that I'm going to have somebody here next week. I really apologize for the last 2 weeks. I think I mentioned this at the beginning of the program. I was not able to be here because of my workload. Unfortunately, I have to rely on work to eat. I think something like that, and have a place to sleep, that kind of thing. And unfortunately, I had the last 2 weeks I was out of town with my job in IT that I do, or actually the complete solution of IT. I travel quite a bit, and it's all within the Gordon Horseshoe and even into Quebec sometimes. So sometimes my traveling gets me away, and I just can't be here. But I couldn't be here for those 2 weeks. I really, really apologize for that. Work kind of took over, but I'm back. I will be back next week. I have a person in mind. I can't tell you two people that I'm going to have coming in here. And one of them is I'm going to have the founder of the Gatehouse, founder Emetius Art Lockhart. I'm also going to have Brad come in here as well. He is the other person that I do my assist training with. They are going to be starting, talking about new programs, kind of like what Paul was talking about here tonight. Well, they're going to be starting a new program that's going to incorporate some forms of Tai Chi or Kung Fu. Don't get me wrong, it's not going to be overly strenuous, so anybody can come in and do it, but they're going to incorporate that into mindfulness and into pause. Kind of like what Paul was talking about here earlier when he came in here. But they're going to incorporate, this is going to be like a I believe it's an 8 or 10 week course. And it's all about self-empowerment. And I'm going to be ever so happy to have these two gentlemen in here. And I'm hoping to have them in here. Well, I could have them in here next week. I'm going to try to find that out this week, by the end of the week. Actually, tomorrow is the end of the week, but I'll try to figure this out by the weekend so that I can post it. But I'm going to try to have Art and Brad here for next Thursday. And I have another guest, again, another group that has started here at the house as well, which has already done the first 12 weeks, and it was very, very successful. And what it'll be about, it'll be I can't even think right now. It's about about alienation, whether it be from your parents, your child, you know, along that lines. And it was a 12-week program that somebody had started here at the house. Actually, two people started here at the house, and one person in particular, lady. I got to get her permission before I say her name, but because she's out of the country. But when she comes back, I'm going to ask her to come here, and we're going to talk about the work. And actually, I wouldn't mind even doing that as well, because I'm having this experience with my daughter anyway, and would like to, you know, dive into that a little bit deeper just to see what comes up. And but anyway, I'm going to have her come in here and talk about the program. And just to give you folks out there, you know, there's another example of another program that the Gatehouse offers, which is free of charge, and that you can come here and do this sort of thing to help yourself. It's all about self-help, and this is just another great example of what's going on. So, okay, I'm going to cross my fingers that I have Art and Brad here next week, but one way or another, I will be here, and one way or another. Well, folks, if I've triggered you in any way, I gave you some numbers earlier. If you're in the Greater Toronto Area, you know, you can always call the Gerstein Center downtown at 416-929-5200 or the GerstenCenter.org, Toronto Distress Center, 416-408-4357 or 408-HELP. If you are in the west end of the city, CAMH, Peel Region, Mobile Crisis Intervention, 905-278-9036. And you can go onto the website at cmhapdufferin.ca/. And if you are in the East End, you can dial, there's an 855 number, 310-2673, or if you're local at 905-898-6455, and on the web at www.ysn.ca/310 space cope. So, and if you're in the U.S. and even Canada to a certain degree, I know Rain, go to rain.org, and they have a chat line on there. You can go on, excuse me, and 24 hours a day to help you if you're feeling triggered in any way. And obviously, you can turn this thing off and not listen to me at all, and just sit with a friend, somebody you trust,
and take some time for yourself, which is also most important as well. Folks, it's really good to be back here. I'm broadcasting live at the Gatehouse, 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard, West in Toronto, Ontario, or Etobicoke, as I like to say, because to me it's still Etobicoke, it's part of Toronto, Canada, that is, Ontario, Canada. We got so many titles. Oh my gosh. But folks, have a good week, a good weekend, most importantly. And if you're this part of Canada, welcome to winter, because snow is starting tonight. I know we're getting quite a bit of snow. I live in the north of the city, and I know we're calling for 10, 15 centimeters of snow tonight up that way. So I know we're going to get some. It probably won't be as much as Barrie and other places get, but in Collingwood, where the skiing goes on. But they're getting snow tonight. So imagine, November the 9th, and it's snowing. And my daughter's out there listening. Happy birthday, Whitney. I just want you to know that, and I love you. Folks, have a good night. Take care of yourselves. I'll see you next week. Good night.